The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. When Ian Manuel was 13 years old, he shot a young mother of two in the face during a botched robbery. Sentenced to life imprisonment, he spent the next 26 years in prison, 18 of them in solitary confinement. He was released at the age of 40 through both the help of his victim, with whom he had struck up a friendship, as profound as it was unlikely, and through the legal assistance of Brian Stevenson, founder of the Justice Initiative. In My Time Will Come, Ian Manuel tells not just his story of a childhood spent in deprivation, his incarceration, and his ultimate redemption, but a larger story of the power of the human spirit over a justice system that too often sentences young offenders of color to life without parole. Tonight, he'll be in conversation with Reginald Duane Betts, essayist, lawyer, editor, and creator of the Million Book Project, an initiative to curate microlibraries and install them in prisons across the country. Betts is also a poet and the author of a number of collections. His latest, Felon, explores the post-incarceration experience. Kiese Lehman writes that Felon will dictate how freedom, power, and consequence are written about until the sun says enough. It is that good. Duane, Ian, thanks for joining us this evening. The screen is yours.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man, thank you for having us. Ian, how's it feel?
Feels good, brother. Good to see you again.
Yeah, definitely, man. Congratulations on this book. Thanks for taking some time to talk about it. You know, I think we share a few things in common. You know, we both were tried as adults, and we both went to prison when we were really, really young. And having also both published books, I think, congratulations. I think one of the interesting things to ask, you know, to just start with is why write a book? You know, can you do two things? One, give us a quick, because, you know, the audience may or may not know a lot about your story. So can you give us a quick piece to sort of frame your story for us and then just answer that question, why write a book?
Yeah, thank you. You know, my name's Ian Manuel. I was raised in a neighborhood called Central Park Village. The Central Park I grew up in was a lot different than the Central Park you guys might be familiar with in New York City. The only time we were jogging was when we was running from police. But I grew up in a life of crime, and just to, you know, give it to you in a nutshell, based on a violent crime, I was sentenced to the rest of my life in prison. I was promised if I pled guilty, I would only receive 15 years. However, I was sentenced to the rest of my life in prison. And at the tender age of 15 in 1992, I was placed in solitary confinement. And I was kept there from the time George H.W. Bush was ending his first term to when Barack Obama was beginning his. So 18 years later, from November 92 to November 2010. And it took, you know, Brian Stevenson, the Equal Justice Initiative, to appeal my case to the U.S. Supreme Court for hours to eventually win my release. But a whole lot had to happen in between those times for me to be released and freed.
You know, it's wild because you just told this whole story in 1 minute, and it's clearly harrowing, you know.
Right.
You go from Central Park to prison.
Central Park to prison. I like that.
And but it's complicated because I hear something like I was living a life of crime, and I always wonder, how do we understand that phrase? Like, how do you understand that phrase now when you think about yourself at 13? Because, you know, a lot of the book does take you back to being 13. And, you know, hearing the stories, even hearing the story of the crime that sent you to prison, it didn't sound like a life of crime as much as young kids being reckless and not having, one, guns being too readily available, and two, just not having a sense of wherewithal, you know, not having a true understanding of what tomorrow might hold. So I don't know, how do you think about, so first, before even answering that, tell me, why write a book? You know, prison is hard. It's hard, you know, why return to that in a narrative?
Well, that's a great question, and thank you for that question, Dwayne. I always felt like I wanted the world to know what they did to me, right? I felt like I lived a life worth, you know, sharing. You know, a lot of people might write a book or do a movie and you're like, oh, you don't find that interesting. But I lived so many different lives in this one lifetime. You know, being released from prison is like being born again. Going to prison is a world inside of a world. Then you go to solitary, that's another world inside of a world with its own rules and regulations, you know? And I wanted to capture the nuances of the criminal justice system and what it takes to survive it with your sanity, your talent, and your humanity intact. I felt like that was worth sharing with the world.
Do you? Yeah, I agree, right? I mean, I think it's never enough stories, you know, and I'm a big believer in stories. I got a book right here called The Freedom Principle.
Right.
It's crazy, you know. It's an art book. It's called The Freedom Principle. And I'm thinking, and then the book under it is called Liberty, right? And so, you know, and then the book on top of it is called My Time Will Come.
Right.
And I'm thinking of the way in which how I first got obsessed with the notion of freedom, like my own and others, was through reading. And so I feel like part of what you're saying is, you know, I write this joint because I think others need to hear the story too. But how did you come to get the skill to write that? You know, can you tell me a little bit about how you developed as a writer inside? Because I know you, like I started writing poetry in prison. So I wonder how'd you develop and then drop something for us, you know?
Yeah, cool. So it is my belief that God gives each and every one of us a gift. Some of us are good at nurturing. Some of us are good at math. You know, you can't come to me with some numbers because it's going to give me a headache. But then you have those of us that are good with words. My gift is the ability to compose words in ways that move people. And I've had that gift since I was a young kid. I remember in the second grade, as I talk about it, My Time Will Come, the second grade teacher, Miss Fort, was giving out awards. And she waited to the end of the ceremony, and I thought my name wasn't going to get called, but she did. She called my name at the end and said, "For reading and writing, Ian Manuel." And I felt so proud as I walked to the front of the auditorium to get my certificates. And I returned to my seat, and my mother's friend, Linda Wright, said, Jim, let me," which is my nickname, "let me see those certificates."
You know, Jim is Southern as hell, man.
right.
Yeah.
I'm from the deep South. I'm from the deep South.
It's Florida, though.
Yeah.
But which is wild, though, because, you know, the on the humble, people be acting like Florida ain't the South. You know what I mean?
Like, but it's not country, right? Like, it's not country.
Yeah, which actually I think that's one of the things that you do a good job of in the book too, is it's like bringing that community to life, and there's some richness there. So early on you was, but how did the poetry come? So early on you was gifted with words, and you're talking about second grade. You get locked up when you're 13.
Right. So I began to find, so someone sent me Tupac Shakur's book, The Roads That Grew From Concrete, and Tupac was one of my heroes. And then I looked at the poetry in the book, and it just looked so simple to me, right?
I'm so glad you said that, because that book was suspect to me. Go ahead.
It was the book, the poetry in the book. This is one of the best artists in the world. Now, granted, he wrote that when he was in high school. You know, he wrote those poems when he was in high school. So,
that might explain some of it.
Right. But still, it's Tupac. And so I looked at it and I'm looking at it, how simple these poems were. And I began to challenge myself to rewrite Tupac's poetry. And then I...
My man say, "All right, look, man, I got this book, man. Tupac, he all right, but I'm gonna go ahead and rewrite these joints. All right, go ahead."
Right, and I'm in solitary with nothing but time on my hands, and so I started rewriting Tupac's poems.
Hold on, what is solitary?
Solitary confinement.
I mean, I know what it is, but for the right. audience, break it down for the audience. So set the scene up, right? Set the scene up, like you in solitary confinement. What does that mean? How old are you when you get this book? And describe the sale so that the folks listening could get a glimpse of what you describe in a book, but so people who don't know could get an understanding of what it means to be in the hole, you know?
So I went to solitary at age 15, and you know, I didn't get that book until I was like in my early 20s. So this was years later. But at the same time, solitary confinement is... I can give you what the Department of Corrections describes it as, and then I'm going to tell you what it really is, because it's embedded in my brain. The Department of Corrections says that solitary confinement or close management is a program where the inmate, through his own behavior, has shown an inability to live in general population without abusing the rights of others.
But you were 15, though.
Right. That's what they say. But that's not what solitary is. So I was initially placed in solitary my first day in prison based on my age, right? That they kept me there for 3 weeks. Then they placed me in open population. And while in open population, I had typical teenage behavior stuff that I would do. I walk in the grass instead of walking on the sidewalk. The officers would yell at me, I'd yell back. I was in an unauthorized area in another dormitory where I wasn't supposed to be. So I accumulated disciplinary reports and they labeled me a management problem for these things. And so they placed me in long-term solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is like at least in Florida, my description of it is like an elevator, you know?
Oh shit, I ain't never heard this one.
Yeah, it's like an elevator. It's like an elevator. Because there's three levels. So just imagine an elevator with three floors. You're on the first floor. The first floor is the most restrictive. You can't have a roommate. You're by yourself for 6 months. But you have to do a perfect 6 months. If you do one thing wrong, within that 6 month time, have a towel hanging on your door, you're caught with another inmate's magazine, or you refuse to go to a call out, or
you don't stand up for count.
You don't stand up for count.
Yeah.
Your time, that's another 6 months in solitary. But if you do six perfect months, then your elevator rises to the second floor. If you could do another six perfect months, your elevator rises to the third floor. And if you could do another six perfect months, your elevator door will open and you will go into open population. However, if you get the wrong type of DR, like a spoken threat, if they lie on you, which they do all the time, like they did on me, and say, you threatened me. I got a DR one time, a write-up one time, where the officer said he came to my door to get me for showers. And then I said, if you open this door, I'm gonna kill you. That put me all the way back down to level one. So I skip level two and go all the way back down to level one and have to start all over again. Mm. It's a never ending, just imagine a crazy elevator that's going up and down, or just staying stuck and the doors never open. And that's why I stayed in solitary for 18 consecutive years. So yeah,
that's an entire bid right there. So you in solitary, I only did 9 years, you know what I mean? Right. So like, I can't even, you know, kudos to you for maintaining your sanity, but also for struggling to become more than you were. And we're going to talk about the crime for a second, but I think that you both maintained your sanity and struggled to become more than the kid who committed this crime. And so all right, talk a little bit about you deciding that you was going to go ahead and rewrite Tupac.
Yeah, so I started rewriting Tupac. It was one poem in there that I was very impressed with. It was the poem that he wrote to Jada Pickett. I still remember one of the lines. He said something like, "You are the Omega of my heart." I'm like, oh, that's cold. You know, that's cold. You are the Omega of my heart. But everything in there was simple. It was straight to the point. And so I started rewriting Tupac, and I started sharing it with my fellow prisoners. They started digging it. Then I started rewriting Maya Angelou, "Still I Rise." I started rewriting Langston Hughes. And then I challenged myself. I said, you know what? If you really want to be successful, rewrite Eminem, "Lose Yourself." If you really think you got this gift, rewrite Eminem, "Stand." Because these were supposed to be the best in the world. And so I did that. I challenged myself and say, "Ian, if you can't rewrite this, then you don't have what it takes to be successful." And that's a pretty large weight to put on your shoulders, because you're talking about a guy that is proclaimed to be one of the best lyricists in the world. But I did it. And the prisoners were amazed. And prisoners, you know, have been broken. They've been abandoned. They've been beaten. They've been left for dead. And so their hearts are hardened. So it's kind of hard to reach those guys. But when I was impressing them, I knew I had what it took to be successful in society.
All right, so let me hear something.
I'll give you a simple one. This one is called "Genie in the Bottle," and it's about solitary confinement. "I'm the genie in the bottle. The world has forgot. They put me in this abyss and closed up the top. I was a little boy when they did what they did. But time continued to tick, and I'm no longer a kid. My mother is dead, and so is my father. I've been abandoned by family while trapped in this bottle. But I hold on to hope that someone will open the top, answer my prayers, and help me out. Sometimes people pick up the bottle and put their eye to the hole. But instead of compassion, acting different and cold. I suffer sensory deprivation, a lost sense of direction. There's no mirror in this bottle for me to see my reflection. They say being lonely and alone are two different definitions, but it's only me in this bottle, so I fit both descriptions. What I need is a friend, someone to extend a hand. It can be as simple as picking up a pen. Someone who cares, accepts me for who I am, my magnetic personality and my baggage from the past. Someone who helps heal the sorrow, will work on building our tomorrows. Someone who refuses to leave me to die in this bottle." Yeah.
Yeah. All right, you hit on it right there, man. I think you were sentenced to die in prison. And one of my homeboys, I mean, I got friends, you know, 20, 30 years, and one of my homeboys actually just was somebody I know. He just made parole, and it hit me. He had lived his whole life, you know, not really knowing when he would get out or if he would get out. And for him, it was a struggle to, he became an imam, and he was always, you know, Muslim and always religious. But, you know, he was striving while inside to become a better version of himself. And so let me ask you, what pushed you to strive to become a better version of yourself first? And then before we open it up for questions from the audience, I want to take a step back and ask, a little bit for you to walk us through the crime. I mean, I know it's in the book, but I just want you to say something about it so we can get a sense of how you imagine you went from being a second grader who was getting awards for reading and writing to a, you know, 11-year-old, 12-year-old who is now like exposed to pistols and exposed to what guns might do. But first, talk about how you became somebody. In a place that was like sort of overwhelmingly filled with darkness. How'd you become somebody in prison and then in that prison within a prison, which is what the hole is for real.
Well, I just always had this belief in these aspirations that I had so much more to offer the world. The officers used to constantly try to reinforce in your mind, particularly me, Manuel, you're an inmate. Who do you think you are? Like, they want you to reconcile, to accept that you're lesser than a human being because you wear blues, right? Because you are a prisoner. And I knew within me that I had value and I didn't devalue myself. And so I had these dreams and these aspirations. And then I knew I had a gift because I would move people with my words. And so that's how I found meaning for myself. And then I started writing DR, disciplinary report appeals, and I started winning the grievances. And I started writing poems for my fellow prisoners and their girlfriends and their wives. And the people would write back and say, who wrote this? This is amazing. Then God started paying me to write ads for them and put them online. So that's how I found meaning, man. I found meaning in receiving praise for the gift that God had gave me.
All right, cool. Now I respect that because I think it's hard. I mean, I think you kind of make it a little bit, and maybe it's just hard to get at it. You know, maybe it's just deeply, deeply hard to get at it. But, you know, because you say it and it sounds simple, but people might not understand.
It's definitely not
years,
simple.
Right. 18 years in a hole is 18 years in a hole. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I commend you for surviving it. But take me back a little bit. How you end up there, though? Because you was 13, man. I mean, like, I'm just trying to figure out. I know the audience is thinking. I mean, be real. My son is 13.
Wow.
You know, and it fucking frightens me to imagine, you know, like him caught up the way I was caught up or caught up the way you were caught up. So, it's just, I mean, how'd you go from puberty to prison, you know?
Very poetically put. I found myself sitting on my girlfriend's porch on July 27th, 1990. And my friends was coming to ask me to go to the game room. I turned them down. Another friend came and asked me to hang out with him. I turned them down. And I kept trying to get my girlfriend to go upstairs with me, and she wouldn't go. So another friend came, called me off the porch and said, Ian, I have a gun. You want to go robbing? I looked around at my girlfriend who I was frustrated with, and I said, might as well, man. Ain't nothing going on here. Hoping in my childlike imagination that she would say, no, don't go. Come back. We can go upstairs now. But life doesn't work like that. And I ended up going downtown. We met up with three older teens. It was a total of four of us. And they kept trying to get me to rob people because they gave me the gun. Rob people in the middle of the street in the broad daylight where it was a lot of crime. I'm like, man, this is too open. What's wrong with y'all? So finally, after a couple hours of this, we all sat down on the curb and we came up with a plan. Well, actually, I passed the gun. They said, Ian, if you ain't gonna do it, get a gun to somebody else. I passed the gun to my friend Marquise. Marquise said, man, I don't want it. He passed the gun to his cousin. His cousin like, I don't want it. He gave the gun to the oldest guy. So now we're passing this gun back and forth like a hot potato, and it ends up back in my hands. Long story short, we make a pact that the next person that we come up to, whether it was in the open or not, we was going to do it. And the next person that we came up to was Debbie and a friend of hers leaning on a car. One guy asked for change. I thought I heard Debbie say she had change. I pulled the gun out, Debbie screamed, I fired. And it changed both of our lives forever. I was arrested 3 days later in a stolen car. And they connected the crime. I confessed to the crime. And that's how I ended up in an adult court. Because Florida has a law that says a child, and it's still on the books, a child of any age that's indicted for a life or death felony shall be treated in every respect as if he were an adult.
Yeah, that shit is magical as hell. They be talking about magical realism. You know, our court system got a wild ass magical realism where, like, you do the most horrific thing you could imagine doing. The thing that should prove and establish that something ain't right. And they use that to assert that you got some kind of maturity. And that's what I find profoundly unsettling. I was tried as an adult too. Face life, but ain't get life. And so, you know, all right, I'm gonna go to the audience questions. But the last thing I want to say though, and I want you to speak on this before we go to the audience questions, is folks should know this though, right? It's also, this is a book that's in very profound ways about forgiveness too.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think the conduit for your release, you know, Brian Stevenson, you know, he did his thing. Attorney Brian Stevenson should be on the Supreme Court. One thing President Barack Obama got wrong, should have put Brian Stevenson on the Supreme Court. But it was also, you know, the person that you hurt the most stepped up and you know, and tell us about that before we go to the audience questions.
So I was 14 years old and I was at my, this is before I went to solitary confinement. I got my legal work from the lawyer that basically sold me to the wolves and said he had reached the end of his rope. So I'm going through my paperwork and I find my victim's name, address, and phone number in the police report.
Which is some bullshit because straight up, they not supposed to have none of that in the report, right? And that's the thing, you know, we tell this lie that that the system is about protecting people, right? But they constantly make those kind of mistakes. Right. And I'm glad that you did something with it that was like powerful and deeply meaningful, because they would not, had you asked for it, they would have legit told you, nah, that's not something we do.
Right.
They would not have tried to be a conduit for you to express what you expressed in that letter. Go ahead, tell the folks what happened. I keep interrupting you, my bad.
It's all good. I went out on the compound and I pressed zero, because back then you could make a live phone call and get a live operator. And I told the operator I have a collect call from Ian for Debbie. She sent the call through. Debbie picked up and said, can you ask him his last name? And I said, Manuel. And then we began our conversation. And I just remember it was around Christmas time of 1991. And I remember saying, Debbie, I'd like to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas and to apologize for shooting you in the face. And then she asked me a question that no 14-year-old should ever have to answer. She said, Ian, why did you shoot me? And I just said, it all happened so fast, man. It was a mistake. Those 15 minutes was up, and then she asked me, I asked her, could I call back? She said, yes. And I don't remember much about that second conversation except one thing. I asked her, could I write her? And she said, yes. And that's how our correspondence started. And she began advocating for my release from prison soon afterwards.
It's a remarkable story, one, because it took a long ass time. like soon afterwards, and it ain't funny, but like, you know, you say like at 14 you had the person who you shot that's like, wait, we could do something else. And the state is like, nah, we think 18 years in a hole is what something else should look like. And I think it's a real example of what it means when you have citizens having far more humanity than a system. And I think that, you know, because that's the case, it bankrupts so many folks that's involved. It bankrupts the judges. It bankrupts the prosecutors. It bankrupts a lot of correctional officers, because they aren't given the kind of vision and the kind of deep moral sense of what we should do to each other that Betty, right?
Right.
That she had, you know. Let's get to some of these questions. You know, I'm going to say the first thing. I'm going to respond to the first question. People always say, I was in a hole a few times, not for 18 years. I just did like 18 months. And people always say, like, why did you get put in solitary? And one of the things is like, as if there is some rational reason. And I think it's like, when you double down on what you said earlier, that is not rational, and that you were a teenager in prison acting as a teenager would act. And so they dealt with you in a way that they thought made the most sense, but there's nothing rational about it. And you already said you were there for 18 years. So that's answer two. How about this one though? How'd you connect with Brian Stevenson? And for folks who don't know, Brian Stevenson is, he founded the Equal Justice Initiative. He is a brilliant attorney, teaches at NYU, but he really committed his life to trying to save young people from dying in prison. And that's what he's basically committed his life from doing. But how did you connect with Brian Stevenson?
I connected by Brian Stevenson when Brian sent me this letter that's in my book, My Time Will Come. He said, out of the clear blue sky one day in 2006, I get a letter in the mail from, I signed for Legal Mail, that and it says it's from Montgomery, Alabama. I don't know a soul in Alabama at the time. And the letter says this: Dear Mr. Manuel, I'm the director of a nonprofit law firm called the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. We have a staff of attorneys who provide legal representation to people in prison. We have primarily handled death penalty cases for the last 20 years. However, we recently began a project providing legal assistance to individuals who have been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole as juveniles. After the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Roper versus Simmons banning the death penalty for juveniles, we started working on the cases of prisoners who were sentenced to life without parole at a young age. In identifying young people sentenced to life imprisonment without parole for offenses committed at 14 or younger, we spotted your case. We believe that there may be a chance to reverse a sentence of life imprisonment without parole under an analysis that flows from the Roper decision, and wanted to know if you were interested.
How much did you understand when you got that, Trey?
So I mean, I did understand it. Like, I did understand law because I had been my own advocate at trying to win my own freedom. I had got the life probation up off of me. So I knew what was going on.
Did you know Roper, though?
Yeah, I did know about Roper. I did know about Roper. And then when I read it, I mean, when I read it in depth, I seen some language in there that let me know, like, oh, this is what, because Kennedy said something in Roper that triggered me. He said
Justice Kennedy, who
yeah, Justice Kennedy, Justice
recently
Kennedy.
Retired. Yeah, recently Justice retired. Kavanaugh got a seat.
He said, like, the death penalty shouldn't be given to a juvenile. And actually, I wonder if life imprisonment, he said something like, I wonder if life imprisonment would be without parole is something a juvenile should have. He just was like letting his thoughts run away with him a little bit. And I guess Brian seen that and ran with it. So Brian sends me this letter. I call Brian. They give me one call. I call Brian and I write him. He says he's going to send two lawyers down to see me. And he sends two lawyers. They take my case and come back with a retainer agreement. Brian's been my lawyer and friend ever since.
Yeah, no, that's what's up. That's like you hit the lottery, man. It's actually like so many, you know, young folks who were grown men when Brian reached out to them, or who didn't get reached out to by Brian. So I think
exactly.
Kudos to you for responding to that letter, but you did hit the lottery on that one.
Thank you.
So one of these questions is talking about what do you attribute coming out of prison with your talent, humanity, and sanity intact versus those people who do not?
Wow, that's a great, great question. There's two things. One was, I think the most genuine answer I have to that is I didn't want to be seen as weak and defenseless.
Yeah.
And because I've seen in prison how you're treated when you cry by the officers and other inmates. I've seen in prison when you show weakness from the chemical agents being sprayed on you. I've seen in prison when people lose their minds, how the officers take advantage of them. So I felt like my mind was my last line of defense against being totally powerless. So that's the first thing. The second thing was, my mom used to say something to me over and over again when I was a little boy. She said, baby, and I talk about this in my book, My Time Will Come. No matter what.
Oh, get the book. Yeah, you got to get the book to read the book. Go ahead.
Right. No matter what, don't never let them take your mind. Don't never let them take your mind. And I don't know who she thought they was, but she. So when I was in solitary, I used to remember those words over and over and over and over again. So it's basically those two things that I attribute to that.
All right. This is a speed round question. Name which one matters the most to you, the one that you find most important. Your talent, your humanity, or your sanity?
I'm more I really appreciate my talent because it's a gift from God, man.
Yeah. You know, and I want to say, though, you know, one of the questions was versus those who people who don't, I think people who come out who, you know, don't have talent, humanity, and their sanity intact, it's frequently because prison breaks people. And I do think we live in a society, I was trained to think the same way you think, which is to say that if I was broken, it was me, it was weakness.
Right.
I've been able to reflect a little bit, you know, as I've had more distance, and I realized that, I mean, the system will try to break you in ways that you can't even imagine or prepare for. And that's why I'm really impressed by what you've been able to do. But also trying to find a way to extend more grace to people who didn't make it out. You know, the people who got broken by solitary confinement, you know. What do you think about the abolition movement?
The abolition movement is something that's needed. And I feel like that, it's something that I like to better understand too.
Yeah, I can respect that. I can respect that. Were you a reader before you went to prison? I know you were a reader early, but you know, in those weeks and months before you end up committing that crime, would you have called yourself a reader?
I started reading at an early age. I can remember myself going to the library, and I was always a Michael Jordan fan. So I think my first books was a Michael Jordan book that I checked out from the library, and I read that. So I did enjoy reading. I did enjoy writing. Sadly, it's hundreds of books that I've read in solitary confinement. Since my release, I've read very few books. Like, it's like the distractions of society and I've written very few poems. It's like the two things that I use to survive while in solitary, reading and writing, which are such strengths of mine, have all of a sudden just disappeared. I don't know where they're at. Like, they come up every now and then, but I wish I could channel them more often, because I feel like it's a superpower I have.
What do you want from the world? You know, you did a bit, you know what I mean? And so I'm wondering, like, yeah, what do you want from the world?
Man, I appreciate that question, because I don't want to be phony, man. I want the second half of my life to be just as doubly good as it was bad the first half of my life. I went to prison at 13, so I did 26 years, double my life in prison, total like sadness, pain. And now I want the second half of my life to be where I don't have to struggle no more. Like, I have to come out here, and the things I have to do on a daily basis just to survive. I mean, I'm working a day job, and then I have to come do all these book events, and I'm doing them. But at the same time, man, you look back and you like, I've suffered and struggled enough, man. I just want to be able to help people. That I want to be in a position of power to help the voiceless, the people in solitary, the juveniles, and the people that can't fend for themselves. I have a whole list of JPay people that I email and support. And this is on a very limited salary that I'm looking out for prisoners. I just want to be in a position to help people, man.
I hear that, man. I feel like a lot of times you do that time, especially when you were young. And one of the things that you miss is all of those years that were spent experimenting on becoming a person you will become. So whether that was trying out different jobs, whether that was acquiring the education that would allow you to work in certain spaces. And I do feel like one of the struggles is to find, truly find a support that's helping people reimagine their lives and to get a foot up. One of these folks asked an interesting question. They asked if you've been in therapy, and I think it's interesting, because you know, when I was in prison, if you went to see the psychiatrist, it was like some sucker shit, you know. And it took me a long time to get over that. I mean, like only recently have I been willing to go talk to somebody. And so, yeah, I wonder about that, though. Have you, you know, once, because, and also I feel like it was like fight mode in prison, you know. Even when shit wasn't violent, though, you had to have your guard up. You had to, like, you couldn't do the kind of thing, you couldn't explore your own vulnerabilities, because you had to be still. But I wonder, have you, you know, been a therapy session since you've been released from prison? And how do you even feel talking about that shit, you know?
I feel comfortable talking about it because I finally see. So first of all, in prison, I was my own therapist. I was my own therapist, and I provided my poetry was my outlet for my therapy. I listened to my thoughts, talked to myself, and I released the pain and emotion through the pen on the paper. So, but upon my release, and plus in DOC, the therapists are working in conjunction with the correctional officers to make your time more harder. There's no confidentiality. They share your secrets with the officers. So you can't trust somebody. But outside, one of the most meaningful things I've done therapy-wise was the Equal Justice Initiative, and some friends sent me to this very expensive therapy program in Arizona called Psychological Service Counseling. And it's an intense therapy program that have equine therapy with horses. They have psychodrama. They have individual therapy. They have group therapy. And they have the electric therapy. And what I find I liked about it was I cried real tears while I was there. I had one session where I couldn't breathe because I was reminiscing about something that happened to me in prison. Then I went to the next session. Again, this is 12 hours of therapy a day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., 7 days a week. And I was there for 3 weeks. And anyway, when I went to the next session, I was like, give me some breathing treatment. I can't breathe. Give me some breathing treatment. And the lady said, no, I'm not going to give you any breathing treatment. I'm like, she said, I want you to face what you're running from right now. Face it head on and just look at it. Don't run from it. Look at it. And when I looked deep inside and looked at what I was running from, I just began to sob deep, hard tears. And my breath immediately came back. And I was like, oh my God, this therapy really works. Therapy really works.
Yeah, that's real, man. I'm glad you said that, because I think about the trauma folks inside face and how, you know, we do spend a lot of time thinking about the crimes that led us into prison, and those of us who've done things that were horrific. I think, you know, nobody could really beat us up about it more than many of us beat ourselves up about it, wondering, are we worthy, and wondering if we could ever make recompense. But I think people don't talk enough about the real kind of trauma that gets visited on folks and how they carry it around with them like a second skin. And so I appreciate you being, you know, willing to answer that question. I didn't even know if I was going to ask you, but okay. I'm glad that that somebody in the chat threw it up there, because I was like, I'm not going to ask this man that shit, you know. Be fuck around, be on this joint crying together and shit, be clowning us on the yard, be like, yo, you heard, man? Yeah, man, Jim and Shahid on the TV crying and shit. let us see another poem, man. Let us see another poem.
Okay. I think I'll do... Every Time I Breathe, maybe. I do that poem so much, man, but it's one of my best poems, so I'll share it. Every time I breathe, I feel the need to justify my existence, to take this moment that I'm living and enjoy every millisecond in it. My life and my struggles, not many can comprehend it. My desire for freedom burns like a sausage inside a skillet. Tomorrow isn't promised, so I'm thankful for this minute. Though in prison merely existing, it's like my life has been suspended. But that means it's temporary, because I haven't been expelled. And I still got a chance as long as I can in and exhale every time I breathe. Every time I breathe, I'm thankful for the oxygen from the trees. And little things like little bees that get overlooked until they sting. Every day I'm faced with obstacles that block the progress to my dreams. But the blockades only masquerades like costumes on Halloween. I've been through enough pain to make a sane man just scream. But instead, I take a deep breath and just breathe. Every time I breathe, the cosmos come out of my nostrils like particles of product coming out of your console. My soul is like a chihuahua you didn't include in your carpool. My lungs relaxed and collapsed like a bottom sitting on a bar stool. Every time I breathe, I become an intergalactic being, stepping out of character like a chiropractor, snapping peas. I prayed so many times, it's like I got arthritis in my knees. But I still get down and bow my head because I continue to believe that as long as I can breathe, God's going to make a change. And my circumstances are only chances for me to glorify his name. You don't know me, homie, but there's odds I've already overcame. So if praying works but hurts, then I can stand a little pain. I want to end this part by thanking God for bringing me to these heights. And I make a promise to always honor and cherish this breath of life. Every time I breathe. Every time I breathe. Every time I breathe. Thank you.
Yeah, man, you got some heat. My computer about to die. I'm trying to plug it up. You got some heat, man. Thanks for sharing that with us. I'm gonna ask this question here. I think we confront this a lot, and I once offended somebody for laughing on a panel, and I was like, "Look, man, this shit is hard. So sometimes I gotta make jokes." And it was interesting because the woman, we were arguing about like whether or not juveniles should get life without parole, and she was saying, "What about the victims?" And I was on a panel with lawyer, defense attorney, prosecutor. Defense attorney, prosecutor, like a medical professional. And she was like, you have people up there representing the courts. You have people up there representing defense. You even have somebody up there representing criminals. But where's the person that's representing victims? And she said, you keep acting like this is a black and white issue. But and had people stand up beside her. And she was like, this person had their child's life taken by a white kid and, went down the line. And she was like, so I want to ask you, what would you do if it was somebody in your family? And one of the questions is like being a victim of a serious crime, especially when their life is at stake, is no joke. And I think that we both fundamentally understand that it's no joke, even if we didn't understand that when we committed our crimes. The person says, I'm trying to understand, even though life is hard, that at that moment there's little thought to what is happening to the victim and the rest of their life if they survive. I think that you've touched on some of how you've confronted that, but I figured, can you just respond to that, respond to that statement?
Yeah. Debbie has taught me a lot about forgiveness. So I truly believe that if someone committed a crime against me, I have the wherewithal now to forgive them. And I already have, because there was crimes committed against me by the correctional officers that was given the charge to secure me in the prison. I was beaten, I was gassed, I was assaulted. And I don't carry the anger around in my heart. I actually have forgiven them, but I haven't forgotten. And part of my reason for writing this book is to expose them to the world for what they done to me and continue to do to others of my friends that I left behind. But Debbie has given me the wherewithal to be a more forgiving person. Because she forgave me for something that I didn't know a person could be forgiven for, man. Shooting them in the face.
Yeah, I know. It's like, yeah, it's hard, man. I am really thankful, though, that she was able to do that. Because I do think, it's one of those things we carry. And I think her forgiveness probably helped her not to carry it around. Somebody mentioned Wilbert Rembert, who just recently passed. And, he did time in prison. His book is out. I can't remember the name of his book, but it's an article in the New Yorker that's basically an excerpt from the book, and it's called Hard Labor. And he became an artist in prison, too. I actually wrote the blurb for that book, and it's a fantastic book, And I think it's all a part of this pantheon. And so spinning off of just mentioning him, I wonder, how do you feel about being in this sort of cadre, of dudes that did time, men and women that did time, Susan Burton, Nathan McCall, Claude Brown, Wilfred Rembert, Randall Horton. I mean, you got these folks who did time in prison and became writers. How does it feel really to have essentially realized the dream? You said you wanted to do it on the inside and now you've done it. I wonder, like despite the fact that you're still struggling a little bit and that you still got to work very hard, but how does it feel knowing that you wrote this thing and it exists in the world?
Well, that's a sense of accomplishment. I also did the audiobook. So when I was doing the audiobook, one of the reasons I did it was the fact that I said, Ian, once you die, this will be here forever. Your voice will be around forever. Your words will still exist long after you have gone. Those correctional officers that was torturing you, you can't say that. You know, you have something, you have contributed something of value to society. Someone saw the value in you that those correctional officers in the wards didn't. So to substantiate my dreams, it felt validating, you know, but I don't want to be put into like a crowd, because that's what they did in prison. Like, we're all our own individuals with our own specific gifts that we contribute to the whole humanity in the universe.
Yeah, and the real talk is like, we are part of this subset of writers who do this thing, but we also part of the larger set of writers, period. You know, like, right. My name ain't been spoken in like Toni Morrison, Ralph Ellison, yep, but that's always the goal for me. Right. That's a really good question. I think we got time for a couple more questions. I want to ask this one because I do think this is something that we want to know about. Can you talk about your transition back into society? You know, I hate that actually, because you was always in society. So let me reframe that, because, you know, we say like, what was your transition back into society? Like, you was on Mars and shit, right? And it's like, nah, you was just in prison. He was just in prison. I mean, society chooses actively to ignore people in prison and act as if they aren't a part of the world. But I guess my question is, what has it been like, you know, moving from prison back to freedom? What does that transition felt like?
It's been a roller coaster. I've had highs. I constantly go through my photos and look back at from the time from when I first was released to now. I see that the things that made me happy when I first was released, the first couple years, I'm looking at myself. I'm like, why am I so happy in that picture? Let me give you an example. Versus something I did. I flew from New York to Utah on a whim when someone offered me a ticket to fly to Utah and stay in their house, some rich guy. And a friend, he's a friend. But
man, these rich dudes don't be offering me no flights to Utah, man.
but listen, it was more, he was giving this life coaching class and he wanted me to be a part of it. And I met him at an event, but he just came back around with that same offer to help promote my book. But I was like, if I do this event, we sell 50 books. I'm flying, I don't know, 3,000 miles, yeah, you know, to it's sell 50 books. I'm like, no, we can do that virtually. You know, you see the difference. I was happy to do it a couple years ago. Like, yeah, I'm going. And he, you know, he did something great for me. He opened up the Utah Jazz's facility. And I told him my fantasy was to go stand in the same spot where Michael Jordan hit the last shot. He made that happen for me, you know?
Yeah.
But me flying back to Utah just to sell 50 books, it just doesn't compute in my more mature mind now as it did a few years ago.
I mean, you know, part of the struggle being a writer is you don't really sell books on the road. And I think that we gotta, you know, you need to think about it like a MC. If you sold 10,000 records back in the day, they was gonna call it a weed plate. But if you sell 10,000 books, you know, most publishers would think that if you sold 10,000, you could sell 30.
Right.
You know, because most writers don't sell a lot of books. So I think, you know, this is like an off topic conversation, but it is a real thing about how do you create a machine that really allows you to sell books. And also what was really interesting is one of my homeboys was I think this was for not the Utah Jazz, this was for was it the Jazz? It might have been Utah. But they set up a book club, and so it was really fascinating that you had these NBA players reading this guy's book And that was a really great thing, a remarkable thing. But look, it's way more questions in the chat than we could get to, you know.
Right.
And I want to thank folks for coming out. I mean, they've really been engaged. I think we've got to a lot of these questions. I think that that more importantly, and I'm gonna tell them this, it's 65 people left. We could go ahead and buy, it was like 70 some people here. They could go ahead and buy the book. A lot of these questions get answered in the book. Far more gets discussed in the book than we could cover in an hour. You know, we thank everybody for coming in, man. I thank you for allowing me to be a part of this. You know, somebody in the chat asks what makes you smile these days. Won't you just answer that? And then we're going to take it away on that note. What makes you smile these days?
Knowing that my value has been validated, waking up and being able to walk outside and just drink cold water, no longer have to walk around in shackles and handcuffs and be treated inhumanely, that I survived what people said I wouldn't. That makes me smile, man. I get to live as a free man in society, man.
Yeah, man, that makes me smile too. Thank you, folks, for coming. I appreciate it. And Ian, congratulations, man. Keep smiling.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.